Michael, episode 2, it's really good to be back. It's really good to have a real microphone. Thank you for joining me.
Here we are, episode 2, Attack of the Clones. This is, it's really great. You know, the last episode was a lot of fun. Felt like we've just been born and now we're heading off into the world.
Michael, before we kick off into the meaty part, obviously our overarching topic is inflation. I just wanted to quickly touch on why should anyone listen to us? And perhaps I'll just quickly speak for myself. Although I don't have the most deep academic knowledge in regards to economics, I don't have a PhD, I studied it and I majored in it in a commerce degree, but rather I have an interest in fairness in society and how we treat each other, how we treat the environment. And I just care deeply about these topics, but I'm not an expert.
Yeah, right. I've also done some study in the area, more in the political law part of the equation. Definitely not an expert as well, but I suppose I take more learnings from the world and read a lot of history books. Do I want to leave the world a better place? I'm not sure. After reading all of this and the history of so many of these price pushes, it's an interesting thing to wrap your head around. It's a big topic, inflation, and we want to keep touching on big topics. We hope we come to you as someone you know, as a friend, to add a bit of a new insight into a topic that can be pretty heavy.
So inflation, it happened. So we had the COVID experience, and prior to the COVID experience, we had a pretty long time of low interest rates and no one really thought they were going to go anywhere. Then the economy changed. People couldn't work in specific industries. Governments initiated a lot of stimulus in the US, $1.9 trillion, which is a lot of money. And then, yeah, prices rose and life got better for some people, worse for others.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just now. I mean, prices have been inflating since the dawn of time. You know, once
they go up.
When you could have bought something for a threepence 100,000 years ago, prices are always going to go up. That seems to be the norm.
It's interesting you say that, Michael, because I was looking at some data the other day, and it is true, but only since it might be about World War II. So, yeah, inflation's always been positive, but winding the clock back, like 400 years, there have been periods where inflation has wildly swung positive and negative deflation, but deflation is very rare in the modern world. Yeah.
Let's jump back and define what these terms are, because it's always important just to take stock. So inflation in its purest sense is just rising prices. Now, obviously, it needs to be coupled with something else, which is reduced purchasing power. So essentially, the money you have is worth less. So you have a dollar today and you can buy a dollar's worth of goods. If inflation goes up, you might only be able to buy 80 cents of goods. So that's the concept of inflation. Deflation is something else. So prices going down. Now, you would think that deflation is a good thing, but it can be a bad thing. So I hope you're going to disagree with me on this, Rich, because my reading on this, a little bit of inflation is a good thing. It means there's money sloshing around. Prices are going up. There's money chasing goods.
Yeah, that's the general consensus, Michael. So, yeah, I'm not going to immediately disagree with you. Of course, as we touched on earlier today, there are so many different viewpoints you can look at this through. And oftentimes, it's not that something's clearly beneficial for all. It may be beneficial for a subset of people or industry. So,
yeah,
I'm not going to...
All right, let's not get a fight just yet, but we might later on.
I hope so.
Might rip our shirts off later on. So deflation is generally the opposite of inflation, so it's falling prices. When there's no money chasing goods and deflation lasts for a long time, you can get into what's known as a depression, the biggest one being the Great Depression in the 30s, which was quite bad. So going from 1929, New York Stock Exchange crash, up until World War II, The only thing that pulled the world out of that Great Depression was the war and the massive spending on the war. So it's a really odd thing that World War II and all the bloodshed was celebrated as getting the world out of the Great Depression, but it was what happened.
It's so true, Michael, and so interesting. Yes, the government spending help the economy get out of a slump. And obviously, the counterfactual there would be, well, what if we just didn't fight each other, but we pumped money into other industries, automotive or clean energy or anything, but just didn't make bombs.
Awesome point. So we're about to rip into the different theories and the who's who and the whole thing. So let's tell you, I hope you lock in for the next 90 minutes. What we want to do is we're going to run through a bit of the introductory stuff. What's inflation? Who's who in the zoo? Who are some of the thinkers in the area? And then we want to jump into some of the products. So if you've gone to the supermarket, you've seen prices going up, that's inflation. If you're going to buy your packet of durries, that's inflation. We want to unpack that a little bit. And of course, you live in Australia, you go to a barbecue, everyone's talking about bloody houses. Of course, that's subject to inflation as well. So we'll get through what it is, how it affects you, and then we'll get towards the end some strategies on what inflation is.
Financial advice.
Not financial advice. Yeah, we are not licensed to give financial advice. We might set up a meme coin, which you're welcome to buy, but we will pull the rug out and take all your money.
As long as we're out front, that's fine.
Yeah, that's it. We if we do release a meme coin, we are going to fleece you. Right. So you were just about to launch into my favorite economist, absolute rock star, the man
John Maynard Keynes,
who has the same name as the lead singer of Tool, Maynard Keegan.
Didn't know that, but thank you.
Well, it's his middle name. And I reckon there's a link there because Maynard Keegan is a pretty cool guy. Probably is an economist as well.
Good on him.
So you were just going to talk about, well, why don't we just pump money into the economy when we're in deflation and pump it back up, which was the views of our man, my man, John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah, yeah, super interesting, Michael. And it's interesting because some of those Keynesian ideas have come in and out of fashion. Like in the 80s, Milton Friedman was the guy, and he was all about small government, not about stimulus. But fortunately, in some sense, during and after the GFC, governments, like speaking for Australia, took a more Keynesian approach and just pumped money into the economy.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of concern, at least from my end, about the distribution of that money. And also during COVID, like a lot of people did very well out of the COVID stimulus, and a lot of people did not so good. Like I know a guy who was running a restaurant and he shut down and he was working in a warehouse. I was working in the warehouse with him. Nicest guy on earth, but he didn't benefit from the period at all. And there were other people, other industries that did really, really well out of it.
It's an interesting one. And if listeners in Australia, if they think back to the GFC around 2000s,
2008 or so. 2008. Yeah. 7-8.
So Kevin Rudd, Ruddy, Kevin 07, he, a bit like James Scallon in 1930, he came into power very quickly and the world economy went straight into a giant toilet fire. And so, whereas previous governments of different political persuasions may have cut spending, and what they do is launch into austerity, which in Britain, you had Margaret Thatcher, who would have launched into austerity, which is one of the ways to tackle inflation, or deflation, which is just to not spend any money and top up your savings. But Ruddy, our man Ruddy, said, no, I'm going to go a different way and I'm going to flood the economy with cash. And as you said, it's a crude tool and it's sort of like throwing a Olympic swimming pool amount of water on a small fire to put it out, and it will go everywhere. But that's the point.
Yeah. I mean, for example, in the States, as you know, Michael, recently I've been trying to get my head back into the economic world for the past couple of years. I haven't really been keeping up to speed on things, but it's always been a big area of interest for me. I'm a fan of the MMT philosophy, the modern monetary theory philosophy. You know, perhaps not all elements, but the theme of it, I understand to be broadly correct, but its application requires some finesse. So, for example, Joe Biden, with his $1.9 trillion stimulus package in the States during COVID, he had a panel of economic experts one of whom, Stephanie Kelton, I was listening to her on a podcast this morning, but they certainly engage a lot of experts or so-called experts and a lot of time to try and ensure that the funds go somewhere useful, but everyone has a different idea of what's useful.
Can you just come back to me? I don't really, I mean, you've said it to me before, but I don't fully grasp what modern monetary theory is.
I have hijacked this podcast. mate, very happy to give a quick...
I'm a willing participant in the hijacking. I've got Stockholm Syndrome, so
yeah,
go for
I'd like to say a few things. The first thing I'd like to say is that I'm not paid by any representative of MMT, although I did give you Stephanie Kelton's book earlier.
Do you work for the US government?
Not to my knowledge.
Are you a spy?
I may have an implant. I'm not sure.
Okay, that's fine. We've all got implants. Thanks to Chairman Dan.
But what's it all about? So it's basically saying that sovereign governments, that is governments that have a central bank, they determine the quantity of their own money supply.
Right.
And for everyone listening who's thinking, oh my God, central banks are separate to the government. In a sense, they are, but the Treasury is the sole shareholder of the central bank. Together, the central bank and the federal government administer that nation's currency. So the concern you hear a lot in mainstream media across the globe is that, oh my God, the deficit's too big, the national debt's too big, we're in trouble, we can never pay back the debt, it's a big issue. MMT is simply saying, no, it's not an issue. The Australian government can't run out of Australian dollars. Australian dollars is like the score in a football match, and the administrator of the score is the government. So there are real constraints to government spending. You can't spend infinitely because you add pressure to inflation.
Yeah.
So you can spend, this is the MMT philosophy, you can spend to the extent that there is real idle capacity in the economy. So let's say you've got 20% unemployment, got people sitting around, no money, nothing to do. Government gets in there and spends some cash. People get employed. Money slushes around. Productivity improves. This is the core theme.
Right. Okay. So let's jump back to another early concepts as well. So back in the day, the world used to be on something called the gold standard. So the gold standard, back in the day, you're walking around in 1850s and you said, God blimey, governor, I've got a £1 note. I want to go into the bank and exchange that for £1 of gold. And of course, Jimmy, you could, because that was the rule. And that's why they called it the gold standard.
Yeah.
And written on pound notes, Australian had pound notes as well, you could say exchangeable for equivalents in gold. And that was the gold standard. So there was always supposed to be a treasury full of gold and then the equivalent cash out there in the market.
Yeah.
And that governed how much money could go away. People went away from the gold standard because they found it constraining, because governments needed money. One, they like to buy elections, and they buy elections through public works, but they also had a social contract obligation to the people for welfare, housing, infrastructure, pensions.
Governance 101.
Waging wars.
Yeah.
They need cash for that sort of stuff. So they said, this gold standard's pretty restrictive. How about we move away from it and we print a bit more money?
Yeah. I understand it's a simple summary of what happened. And there's a bit more flexibility in this system. You can tax what you like. You can spend what you like. And your only real constraints are what the economy can handle. I mean, a crude analogy, if the economy was an engine, it's like, I mean, you're driving a Corolla, you can get that to 200.
Yeah.
But there may be consequences.
Can I come to some of those consequences? Please. So because, of course, one of the problems with printing money, and that's how you increase the supply, you crudely print more money, which is there's a fancy term for it, quantitative easing. But what that means is the currency can get diluted. So there were some horrific cases that always gets brought up in this discussion of the Weimar Republic in the 1920s, when the German government was smashed in World War One, and they were dealing with reparations, and they needed to feed their people, they needed to rebuild the country. And so they said, well, how about we just print Deutschmarks, and they just kept printing and printing, printing to the point where it was worth nothing. And the what I read was there was one loaf of bread was worth 200 billion Deutschmarks. And this was one of the reasons that they got into World War II. They didn't learn the lesson from the first one. They thought, let's have another fun go at it. And thankfully, they'll be on our side in World War III. And it's not the only country. Zimbabwe did a similar thing. They printed money for public works, and then the Zimbabwean dollar became worthless. So isn't that a problem with modern monetary theory?
A couple of things. Firstly, I'll cut this bit out, but just careful with your arms on the table, because that'll come through the mic. So a couple of things. So QE, as I understand it, is the central bank's purchasing of assets. So yeah, it does inject cash into the economy. But I understand that's the mechanism. What do I think about it? Hyperinflation. Yeah, it's not good. You don't want any of that. What do you think about it?
Well, I think it's a bad thing. I think there's a middle ground. There's a middle ground between hyperinflation, the examples that I just gave, and deflation. So you never want there to be no money sloshing around, but you never want there to be too much money sloshing around.
Michael, you know what? This brings me to a thought that is important. If there's a little bit of inflation, it is an incentive to spend money, right? Because if you have that sitting in your account, that its real value is just diminishing over time. If you had deflation, why would you spend your money? You just park it in the bank because its value is going up relative to your goods and services. Yeah. So you can see why there's an engineering reason for a little bit of inflation.
Yeah, and from what I read about it, is it's also a bit of psychology. So things are going up. Prices are going up. I better buy it now. I better buy it now before it gets too expensive. Price is going down. I don't need, there's no motivation for me to run out. And the whole concept of the economy, it's a big circulation, a big churn of cash.
It is.
If you've got money sitting in your bank account. So Kevin Ruddy back in the day was putting $900 in people's bank account, and everyone called
it. I missed out on that, and I'm still salty.
Well, my wife got it twice because she is a citizen and a student, so she had cash sloshing around. I don't think I got it.
Good for her.
It was called the plasma TV bonus because people were going to go out and spend it, but that was the whole point. So the whole point was to put money into the hands of people that don't need it.
Money rushes through the pipes and the sluices, revitalizing the economy. Everyone
gets excited, rush of blood to the head. People are going to the nightclubs. Back in the day, we were buying Maduri Illusion shakers, cowboy shots.
All the essentials.
Oh, man, we were having a great time. The mid-2000s, the 2010s, they were a fantastic time. So what Ruddy was trying to do is to stem that deflation, and it was about just flooding cash. Of course, it gets us into debt, but this episode is not about debt. It's only about inflation and deflation.
Oh, but what if they're related?
Of course they're related, but everything's related to everything.
So what do we want to say about inflation, Michael?
I think maybe we've said enough about what it is. Let's talk about some of the causes.
Oh, I would love to talk about that. Do we have tariffs on the list?
We can get to tariffs. Well, I mean, there's generally two broad reasons.
Yeah.
There's what they call cost push inflation.
Price pull.
And then there's demand pull inflation.
Okay.
But then you can fit more into that.
Give us the rundown. How do we get a bit of cost push inflation?
This is how I split it. So cost push. So right, I'm making a can of Coke, and I can make that can of Coke for 20 cents. But then Mr. Aluminum, if you live in the great United States, says, well, I need to sell that can for more. And then the people that make the coca leaves that go into the Coke say, well, you know, I could be making more money selling to the median cartel.
So your inputs go up.
That's right. My prices are going up. So all of a sudden, that can of Coke can't be made for 20 cents. It now needs to be made for 25 cents.
Yeah.
And I'm Coca-Cola. I'm not going to wear that cost.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you pay.
Yeah.
So that is an example of cost push inflation. This other one, demand pull, it's a bit more, makes a bit more sense. It's about controlling scarcity. So it's the old supply and
Taylor demand. Swift tickets.
Exactly, exactly. When there's not enough goods but too much money, the price goes up. Why does it go up? Well, it's...
Because you've got to distribute the goods somehow. It's the only way we know how.
Well, there's a good reason and there's a nefarious reason. The good reason is, I need to create scarcity because there's not enough to go around. So I need to price some people out of the market. So I need to raise it to the point where you can't afford it anymore. And then the people at the top end of the market are buying what's made, and then we're in what's called price equilibrium. So there's enough goods for the people that can afford it. The nasty reason is something called profit inflation, and we're going to come to that later on. And that's just greedy Mr. Monopoly with a top hat going, you've got money, I want the money, I'm not going to change my product at all, I'm just going to get into your pockets, rumble around in there and take your cash.
Mate, this is a really interesting one and I want to talk about it. I don't have the answers. I have more questions than answers, but I've read a few articles on it. I understand that during the COVID period after the stimulus, speaking only for Australia, I believe it's similar globally, there was a lot of that increased markups beyond.
Completely. I did a bit of research in this because I wanted to come to our products later on. So during COVID, there were two competing arguments that the RBA, the Reserve Bank of Australia, let's quickly talk about why they exist. So they exist, they were created in the 90s to control inflation. So they needed to sit within the 2 to 3% bracket.
So I didn't even know this. What did they have before the RBA?
Just madness.
Just John in accounts.
Just people in the streets fighting each other for a can of beans.
This is so interesting. I'm literally on ChatGPT right now trying to find the history of the RBA. I need to know, Michael.
Yeah, it was created. It was created in the 90s. Could have been the 80s. But it was definitely created at a time because before then, inflation was just running up and down. So there wasn't really control of it. So what the RBA does, and all central banks, you were talking about the US Reserve, it's the same thing.
Oh, mate, I've just got to do a quick fact check here. So Commonwealth Bank established in 1911 and then...
They're completely different.
Yeah.
The Reserve Bank of Australia.
I know, mate.
They're completely different.
By the 1950s, they wanted to separate. The Reserve Bank Act 1959. Sorry, mate. Sorry to rain on your parade.
But they only started coming in to control inflation.
Oh, okay. Before that, they were just letting it roll. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. So that's what I was talking about. I'm gonna see your
mate. Counter fact check me.
See your fact check.
See, this is good.
And I'm gonna throw it back in your
face. Please do. Please do. I like it.
Yeah. So this is like Street Fighter, and you've done a Ryuken, and I've done a Guile back to you.
You're right about the inflation target.
So have a look at that graph.
I'm looking at a graph.
See that blue line there.
All right, so
that's when the inflation target came in.
All right, so for the listeners, Michael's just shown me a graph and we've plotted a bunch of recessions, the OPEC oil price shock, 1979, 1982 recession, 1991 recession, Asian financial crisis, 1997.
Look at the blue line.
I'm looking at it. So we've got a blue line. I fully acknowledge the blue line.
We've got to get this graphic up later on. So what it shows is that before then, the great, heavy, frothy market, there were winners and losers, there were peaks and troughs, there were booms and busts, and there was a decision made, a good decision to say, let's try to control inflation a bit more. All right, so we just had a brief moment there whilst we had a fist fight over the blue line. So the RBA in that period gets set a task to keep inflation between 2 and 3%. So whilst we all throw bombs at the RBA, whilst we all throw bombs at the RBA about rate cuts and taking money out of our pockets, which they do by raising interest rates, that's their reason for existing. So there's a lot of pain, but that comes along with the whole plan. The plan is when there's too much cash in the market, so inflation's out of control, they raise interest rates through what's called monetary policy. They raise interest rates, so it's intentional that they take the money out of your pocket, and some people lose their jobs. all of that is part of the system. There's cruelty built into the system.
Yeah, I agree, Michael. And the MMT view is that it's a bad tool for trying to dial up or down the economy. The MMT view is that if you're trying to reduce inflation, you want to take money out of the economy, you can do that with taxation,
yeah.
Right? And my hope is for a fairer economy. So I'm concerned with the distribution of wealth. I would rather see the uber wealthy just taxed a bit more rather than interest rates bouncing up and down.
Look, I don't want to get taxed anymore, but I also think the interest rate thing is a foolish solution. Why do I think it's? Because that money that's coming out of our pockets is only going into the bank. The bank's not reinvesting that back in the community. They're just taking that as shareholder wealth. So you've sucked value out of people that have earned it, and then you're just redistributing it, some sort of like crude reverse capitalist socialism of taking money out of someone and then giving it back to someone who doesn't need it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the banks don't hurt when interest rates go up. They just pass on the rate increase from the central bank. They pass it on plus margin.
Yeah, immediately. Yeah, I mean, let's get real. These guys are not here to save the world or save the whales or hug a tree. They're there to make money and they make money through our money. So, of course, if someone says to them, hey, Mr. Bankat, we've got a plan so you can make more money by doing nothing as long as you back our interest rates, they'll go, that sounds like a freaking great idea. I'm going to get on board.
Banks exist to make money. I guess all corporations exist to make money. But how we make the money matters, and the system in which we operate and how it's structured matters.
We matter.
We matter.
We matter. We're special.
But I think we skipped over something there. Probably two things. One is the mechanism for how interest rates are implemented. And honestly, my knowledge in that area is not complete. I understand that the central bank raises rates and then the banks have to pay higher rates to the central bank. I need to understand more about all of that. But
it's the cash rate. So banks are always... So banks actually don't have a lot of money. They just have other people's money. So your wages go in there.
We can fight about this. This is good. You keep going because I'm gonna disagree. Go ahead.
We just had the blue line fight. We'll have another one. So my money goes into the bank. It's sitting there. The bank uses my money to lend out more money. So they create fake money. So my wage, let's say I made $100 a week. I'm doing quite poorly. Yeah. So it goes into the bank and they go, oh, thanks, mate. I'm going to take your money and I'm going to carve it up like some sort of giant... Do you remember the never-ending box of Tim Tams?
Remember there being like 11 or so in a box.
Well, there was some genie and then someone wished for a never-ending box of Tim Tams. So whenever you took Tim Tams out, it would always reappear. So let's go with that analogy. So this... My wage is a box of Tim Tams. So they're just going to be flinging Tim Tams out to all their mates. They're lending all this money out.
Yep.
The banks... Where did I get to?
So what you were describing is the concept of fractional reserve banking, which is still believed by some economists, but from the MMT crowd, from the Central Bank of England, the Bank of England, they would all dispute that. And
I was getting on cash rates. That's what I was getting.
But
the cost of borrowing between banks.
Yeah. But the fractional reserve banking thing is interesting. The way I understand it is that commercial, and this is the MMT lens and the Bank of England lens, is that commercial banks, when they create a loan, they simultaneously put cash in your account. Which is a liability for
taking
them.
Taking out of my account. They're taking money. Putting money in your account.
They
took it from my account.
Sorry, when you get a loan.
And then they gave it to you.
Commercial banks create money by giving loans. So they simultaneously put money in your account for a loan and increase their asset by the same amount.
Yeah, but the cash rate is the bit that is a mechanism that is influenced by the interest rates.
Yeah. So at least in my mind, the mechanism of how the cash rate is passed on to commercial banks I don't understand the full picture.
Well, there. It's the same sort of thing. So it's sort of it's cost push inflation. So the cost to the bank borrowing from another bank goes up. So the bank goes, out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to pass it on to you. So during the inflation, the COVID inflation, we were getting multiple letters a day, and the interest rate and it affects people in mortgages. That's how people feel.
That's right. So let's say you got 5 paid off houses, you're laughing.
That's right.
Cash in the bank, you're laughing. But if you've got a mortgage, you're hurt. And if you're a renter, you're hurt because your landlord's trying to recoup the money.
And this is why there was so much pushback on this. And let's jump now to products. We've covered all the intro and it was pretty heady. So you might want to pause this, go and have a lie down, have a cup of tea or something. And then we're going to get into the products of how things get inflated.
So what we're getting at here, Michael, are we saying that things don't inflate equally?
No, inflation is not equal. And the other interesting thing about inflation is it can hide a lot of things. So if something goes up, but something goes down, and something else goes up, but then 10 other things go down, then you're missing the meat, the delicious meat in the sandwich.
So you're saying in a scenario where this occurs, you could have someone whose basket of goods that they rely on day to day, person A's basket of goods went through the roof, and person B's basket of goods went down.
Great.
Winners and losers.
Before we get into the actual products, let's get into the basket of goods, because anyone who's interested in economics, the word basket of goods would have peaked them off, and that they'd be really pinging at the moment. So there's something called the CPI, or Consumer Price Index, and that's what's used to track inflation, and it's been around forever. So it started in 1910s, and the version that we know of is broken up into many different categories of things that we would all spend our money on. So the categories are food and non-alcoholic beverages, alcohol and tobacco, clothing and footwear, housing, furnishing, household equipment, health, transport, communications, recreation, education, and insurance and financial services.
Do you have the weightings in front of you, Michael? Because that would also be an interesting discussion, or is that too much detail for today?
I don't have the weightings, but what I can tell you, I've got some interesting stuff here. So it started in 1910, and it's going all the way up now to 2025. So it tells a story about society, about different things that were in the basket of goods. So what they do is they put things in a basket of goods, and they track the price of that basket of goods quarter on quarter in the capital cities of Australia. So back in the 1910s, we had such uninspiring things as flour, tea, coffee, sago, kerosene, candles, and mutton.
We have iPhones.
That's not, and we do have iPhones in there now. And we wouldn't.
Bit of tech.
We don't buy as much mutton as we should, and that's a shame.
I buy heaps, man.
Do you?
Yeah.
My mum used to talk about mutton, but she grew up on a farm that was really grim, so.
At least they had that for consolation.
That's right. That's right. And then in the 50s, we had ice cream and soft drink in there and electric toasters. 70s, we got takeaway food when people didn't eat the same slop that they'd be eating forever. 80s, we got credit card charges in there. The 1990s, we got exciting things called home computers, back when they were massive and they took up a whole table. Interestingly, in 1998, one thing got pulled out of the CPI. Do you know what it was?
Let me have a think. Leather goods?
No, they're still in there.
Okay.
Bondage gear, that's still in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
As long as that's captured, I'm happy.
Let me give you a clue. It's all John Howard's fault.
What does John Howard not like? So what was removed from the CPR?
But it was, I think,
the Quran.
I haven't linked this up, but I've got a bit of a conspiracy. So housing was pulled out of the CPR. So housing, what always goes up in Australia? Housing. But you know what's not measured? Some parts of housing, but not all parts of housing is measured in CPI. So that got pulled out in 1998.
So what parts? I'm interested in that, and I haven't looked at it in some time. What housing is included? Is it just rent, or is a mortgage payments included?
So we've got parts of it in there. So we've got So we've got some renters in there. We've got, let's have a look. We've got some parts of housing, but not all the parts of housing. We'll come back to it. But I think that's an important thing to remember is, and the reason I brought it up, one, because I think the housing market is John Howard's fault. And two, it goes to show that inflation, the inflation figure can hide a lot of things.
Yep.
For good or bad. And then in the current, we've got iPhones and other things in the CPI. So that's the part that when people saying inflation's going up and you'll say, but is it really going up? You might have some touch points. We're going to get to the touch points about supermarkets and other things. But they'll be looking at the headline figure of inflation, and that's that basket of goods, which is supposedly the normal amount the of
average things basket. That yeah. people would yeah. buy. So basically, if you own your own home and you're not paying a mortgage, you're kind of doing okay, right? Because the consumer goods stuff is like not super expensive. I know we saw some inflation in food and whatnot throughout COVID, but as you say, housing has been increasing higher than many other categories.
Let's get to food.
Yeah.
Let's get to food. So one of the things we were talking about before is profit inflation. So during COVID, costs went up. But how much did they really go up?
Well, this is what I want to know, Michael. I want to know though that profit chunk of the inflation, those markups, what enabled them? Was it the stimulus? Like, because at any point in time, a company is always going to raise prices to the point that they can, right?
Of course. There's this great concept that I'm stealing from a Bloomberg journalist, Tracy Alloway. Hi, Tracy.
Thanks, Tracy.
Tracy came up with this concept called excuseflation. You could just put any sort of prefix on inflation.
But if the money wasn't there to purchase it, they couldn't get away with it, right?
They couldn't get away with it, of course, because you can only... Why would you raise prices if you didn't know there was money to chase it? In Australia, the supermarkets, there's two of them. We call that a duopoly. And they've been accused of behaving together in a cartel. Don't sue me. In a cartel, which means that you talk to your mate. Like you're, let's call it supermarket A. You go down to the pub with supermarket B. And you say, hey, what are you selling dog food for this week? Oh, $20? $21? Good idea. So if you raise pricing at 21, these are goods that people need to buy. If you either have a dog or you like the taste of dog food, you're going to buy dog food. And if your options are supermarket A, supermarket B, they're the same price. And they go, how about we put it up again next week and next week and next week? And that's just profit. So that's not indicative of cost. So you have cost push inflation, which was a real thing because they did have supply chain problems because people were locked down with COVID. They couldn't leave. Fuel had gone up. That's another thing. We're going to talk about fuel in a second. There was restrictions of people coming into the shops. But did it go up that high? That's the question. And did the supermarkets behave together like a cartel? That was the accusation. And that went to a Senate inquiry. And because the political parties get donations from the...
It just quietly went away? Is that what happened?
It went away. But it's obviously a real thing. What's been your experience of supermarkets?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. Michael, I've got a few thoughts on that. But probably need to do some deeper diving. I know there was some pretty good data to indicate that they were behaving in cohorts on their pricing. Like 1 week, item A would be discounted at Coles. Mm. Next week, it'd be discounted at Woolies. And they'd just alternate to share that, I guess, that technique, that profit, 50-50.
Cartel behavior.
Another thing I thought was that their bottom line, their profit figure, I didn't think it was that obscene. Like the way it was reported was like, oh my God, Coles has made $10 billion or whatever it was. It was some enormous number. And everyone's like, oh my God, it's such an enormous number. But I'm thinking, well, we should look at that in percentage terms and what's reasonable for that industry and other industries. Actually, I'm not sure it was that obscene.
But this is the problem, right? Because, you know, we live in a free market. We don't live in a controlled economy. So anyone can make as much money they want. But the restriction is supposed to be some sort of equity or social license. You live in a society. You can be a complete schmuck if you want to be. But ideally, you're not. Because then you have customer loyalty and people come back to you. What this felt like was people needed food, quite important. People needed toilet paper because COVID for some reason meant everyone needed to have really clean bum holes. So they bought heaps of toilet paper. And the supermarkets took advantage of this. Now, at the back end of this, when you say profits is fine. Gordon Greco said greed is good. But at the same time, suppliers were losing out because they weren't getting paid money.
Yeah.
Remember the milk war where they were going to the farmers and saying, we're going to sell this this milk for $1. So you need, yep, to, you need to take 10 cents.
Yep.
So you're making record profits. You're pushing your suppliers down. At the same time, they're getting to labor disputes with their workers. So,
yep,
right, you've got a pie, you're eating all the pie, and you're leaving me with the crumbs, and then you're charging me for the crumbs.
Yep. Oh, I agree. They're not altruistic. They do provide a service. We're hooked on it. We're hooked on the convenience.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing about supermarkets is, And you've seen it when the shelves don't have things on them, and it becomes a bit of an existential dilemma or an existential crisis. You think, oh my God, it's so convenient every week to go and buy food. But if that goes away, what am I going to scrap around in the dirt? Am I going to go down to the lake and get a swan? And
mate, there's so many carp in Albert Park Lake. It'll keep you going for weeks.
But don't they taste bad?
I think there are some Europeans and maybe Asian cultures that know how to cook them. Mm. I mean, I'm not sure.
I'd eat the swans.
Yeah, man. Do you know, it's, I believe, at least in Britain, it's illegal to eat swans unless you're royalty.
The Queen owns them.
Yeah.
I think it's a loophole in Australia, though. We should consume
as many swans. Heaps in the lake. Mm. I have no idea what they might taste like, but if we're in a really tight situation, I think there'd be a bit of competition for them. Mm.
Right. So, we shit all over the supermarkets.
Who else do we have in the crosshairs?
Housing.
Oh, man.
You could probably talk about this because you are of the generation that is going to be sleeping under a bridge with a cardboard box.
Yeah, man. I'm getting ready.
Mm. You got a nice box?
I should be able to get one in the recycling area of my building.
Nice. Smart. What do you think about housing?
Mate, I've got lots of thoughts about it, and I've had lots of thoughts for a long time. I guess at this point, I probably have fatigue over the whole topic. But I could run you through some of the thoughts I've had in the past. I mean, I wrote an article on housing some years ago, and what I was trying to get across is that in Australia, we are incentivized by tax to purchase housing as an investment. And I don't like that because you invest in something in the hope of getting a return, right?
Yeah.
So you're buying a house because you think you're either going to get a good rental yield or capital gain or both, and it's going to be worth your time. Mm. And so either the renter or the next person that buys the property is going to get a worse deal than what you're getting right now because you're saying there's a positive net present value of me purchasing this property. So it's kind of like the Hunger Games in that not everyone can win that game, right? Because
great analogy.
Because we're saying that, okay, if I'm lucky enough to be a property investor, buy at the right price, I profit on it. Where does the profit come from? Well, it comes from the market. What is the market? It's other people. And this is over a good that has the most tangible benefit of all goods, right?
Yeah.
Housing's fundamental. And I'm pretty passionate about it, Michael. It shouldn't be insane to think that all the people that live in Australia deserve a house. Like, it doesn't need to be a mansion. Like, at the very least, like, know, for individuals, a lockable room, at the very least for families, a unit, a couple of bedrooms, amenities. We're not a poor country. We can provide this, and we don't. Like, the distribution of housing is so inequitable, in my view.
Completely, yeah. And that's intentional. That's intentional. The houses in Australia are an investment. They're a commodity. They're being commodified. So we've moved away from it being a right. Well, it's never been a right, but
yeah.
You've hoped that it was a right. It's sitting right up there in Maslow's system of needs, right up the top, next to red wine and cheese. But that's all been engineered. So back in the 90s, houses were just houses. People lived in houses. And then there was a few policies that were put in place, and now we've got this crude reality where the prices of houses have gone up in the last 30 years. Guess how much they've gone up?
I don't know. Percentage. But mate, I'm not sure. But relative to income, a lot. Like maybe relative to income, it might have gone up twofold or something.
453%.
Okay, so yeah, in absolute terms, so different measures. That's quite a lot, but you know, it depends on what metric you want to look at.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
There's going to be some inflation. That's
the important thing about inflation. You can't just look at prices alone. So
if
wages are rising in line with inflation, then it doesn't really have an impact across the board. It might have an impact on some products, and that's the important thing to remember. And that's why often, if you have a job or you're in a union and they adjust for CPI increases, it means every time, every year where they adjust for inflation, you get a bit of a kick. Now, that's not more money in your pocket. That's just meaning that that's adjusting for that can of Coke is now $1.20 instead of being a dollar.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Michael. Yeah, I think probably the housing inflation probably hurts the most people in the deepest way, because you have to fork out such a large percentage of your wage.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. So like on average, we spend about 20% of our incomes on housing. But for the people in the bottom, let's say 20% of income, that could be over 50%. And that's severe.
Yeah. And the world costs a lot because the basket of goods keeps going up.
Yeah, and you just can't take housing out of the basket. There's no substitute for housing. Like, the substitute is the street,
but it's not under a bridge, right? But it's not in the basket.
Let's get in the basket.
I want to introduce two people. One who's one of my favorite people in the world, Mr. Paul Keating, and one who's one of my least favorite, but I think he's one of your mate's favorites, John Howard.
When you say my mate, which mate, without identifying him too?
I think he's in your family.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Well, he's been good to some people in my family, let's say.
Okay.
So, yes. Some policies that he's implemented have been good to some people.
And that's a very good point. He picks winners. He was a winner. He picked winners, and the winners backed him. And that was the whole point of his housing policy. So, he realized that if people have a house, they're homeowners, they're also voters. And it was a quid pro quo. It was scratch my back, and I'll help you out. That's what it was about. So previously in the 80s, a house was a house was a house. And then when we had a change of government, Paul Keating, the man who gave us such lines as calling John Howard a desiccated coconut.
I missed that one.
Calling Peter Costello all tip and no iceberg. But the greatest line, when John Hewson asked him to bring on an election, he says, "But I want to do you slowly."
He was
an absolute legend of politics. He's still around. God bless him. And so when Howard came in, he reduced the capital gains tax by half. He kept negative gearing in. To his credit, it already existed, but he kept it in place. And then, you know, we were talking about too much money chasing too few products. He rolled out some things. Now, whether he knew this was going to go bad or not, I'm not sure. But things like the first homeowner grant, when that was around, and actually a lot of grants for housing maybe have been thought to be good, but actually ended up being much, much, much worse.
I agree, Michael. Yeah, grants for housing.
Because if you give people money and I'm selling something, either I need to control scarcity, so I need to push the price up, that's one, or I'm a real dirtbag of a person and I think, you've got more money. I like money. I'm going to take your money and I'm not going to change anything about my product.
Well, yeah.
Both of those things happened. One, there's a housing supply problem in Australia. And two, everyone's getting fleeced. The third thing is houses went from being houses to being McMansions. So Australians, I'm a proud Bogan from Proud Bogan Stock, but even my house is much nicer than the house I grew up in. The McMansion problem in Australia meant that the price to build a house costs way more.
Sure, but I think the inflation that we're talking about that goes along with housing is overwhelmingly tied to the land. And I understand, especially during COVID, the price of construction has gone up a lot. There's a lot of inflation there. I agree.
Yeah. And there's a lot of there's another type of inflation we haven't got to. It's called speculative inflation. So back in the 1600s is a great
tulips.
Example. The tulip mania. If everyone remembers back in...
is this like the AI of the 1600s?
This was when in Netherlands, tulips were a tradable commodity and people liked tulips. And there was this new legit tulip on the market and people were going gangbusters for it. So they were spending all their thruppence. I don't even know what the currency was in the Netherlands at the time. But anyway, there was a massive bubble. So a bubble's called a bubble because it expands and then it breaks and it pops. And what you found was what looked solid from the outside, there's actually nothing inside. That's what a bubble is. So prices get so high, they get driven up by speculation, by people bidding. If you've ever been to an auction of for a house, which is one of the grossest things in the whole world, and everyone's going,
yeah, it's pretty uncomfortable.
Remember that show on the block and they're saying, 1 million, 5 million, 10 million. And you're thinking, this is gross. This is actual money. And they're just making up the price of it. The price is not based on it, and that's speculative inflation. So then we get to the point of people having more money, so why not? So you look at the price of some crap shack in Sydney, and it costs $10 million for an absolute toilet. Like, you're paying $10 million for the toilet, which is attached to another toilet, inside another toilet.
What a nightmare.
It's good if you like toilets.
Yeah, we need them. We just don't want to live in one.
Yeah, so housing. So now we've got to the point where housing's out of control and it's not affordable. And we're trapped now in this vortex where the government's saying, well, we need to make it more affordable. So how about we give you money? And then the market's going, I'm going to suck up that money and I'm not going to give you a house. So now the whole thing is just out of control.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, Michael. I'm not a huge fan. I think there's a lot that the governments could do to make housing more affordable and more accessible. Obviously, the investor thing is one thing. I think it would be easy yet unpopular because roughly two-thirds of voters are homeowners.
You can't forget that. That's ever-present. Yeah. Politicians are robots that live on votes.
Yeah, and I think it's federal politicians have on average 2.5 homes. So so they're incentivized. If
Dutton, they've got more.
They represent investors, both sides of politics.
Even Albanese, the battler from Baldwin has got a harbourside mansion.
They all do. It's not good. What I'm trying to say, taxing investment properties would be a simple, excellent solution to swing things towards favour of people that don't have homes, but we're not going to do it because it's politically unpalatable.
They've tried things, there's foreign investment, try to cap foreign investment in houses.
Yeah, that's another one. And also another thing we need to acknowledge, and it's a very sensitive issue and people misinterpret and get offside, is that everyone in Australia needs a home, right? That includes the people that live here currently, includes people that come in, migrants from overseas. We all need somewhere to live, right? So we need to make sure the ratio of homes to people is appropriate for our society.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is what they call fiscal policy. So you see a problem. Again, it's another crude thing because a tax, when applied to someone who can't pay the tax, is cruel. So you're also trying to tax someone, take money out of that and redistribute it. So yeah, you've got this market that's completely out of control. So someone is trying to intervene to take money back out of it through taxation, which is never effective.
Well, yeah.
People are very good at avoiding, well, not people like us, but smarter people.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
People with a lot of money, like Kerry Packer said, if you're not avoiding tax, then what are you doing? I've butchered the quote, but...
Sure, yeah, that's effectively what he said. Mm. But yeah, if you're rich, you don't need to be smart. You can just pay a smart person, pay a smart lawyer or group of smart lawyers.
And then you don't pay the tax.
Yeah, sure.
You would just avoid the tax.
Yeah, but at the moment, we just don't have the appropriate taxes, in my view, because we have a few concurrent crises around housing, but one problem we have is a distribution problem, right?
Yeah, we don't have enough houses.
We don't have enough, yes, but also the distribution of the houses. For example, we have investors with multiple homes, we have people with zero homes, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So society has allocated this scarce and valuable resource in an unfair manner. Well done, society. But that's a bit negative.
Right, let's try to raise the tone. Let's talk about inflation on some other things that we hold near and dear, and that's booze and smokes.
What do we have anything? I mean, sorry, Michael. I appreciate that you've probably done extensive research on this particular
topic. Top points, man.
Okay. What do we have to say on booze and smokes? And then perhaps if we have time or the interest, I mean, I'd certainly like to talk about what Musk is trying to do in the Treasury. I know it's a bit of a current affair, but it could have an impact on inflation. Trying to shut down those Treasury payments. I'd like to talk about that and also potentially tariffs if we have time and interest. But ciggies and booze. We're talking about like governments slapping taxes on those things. What are we talking about?
So we're trying to get to the point of, the great Australian dream is, you go buy some beers, you go buy some spokes, you sit down at the Bricky's laptop, and then you can waste your money. What the government does, and it's a funny odd thing with things like excise taxes. They're supposed to discourage people from drinking beer and having smokes, but at the same time, the government gets rich off these excises. They love them.
Yeah, and fuel and ciggies, they're hard to give up.
That's right. And at the same time, if you're into petrol and ciggies. So it's hypocritical, especially I'm a big wine drinker. So wine costs a huge amount in Australia. It's a massive industry. It's a $45 billion industry. So that's taxes go into that. So if you were ever wondering why beers and smokes are so expensive, it's because the government is taxing you, which is another way of causing inflation.
Yeah, well, at least on those items. I mean, I think there's more to that, though, because I think it depends what the government does with an equivalent amount of tax money. So let's say it gets a bunch of revenue off those items. Yes, that's true. But if it doesn't then again spend an equivalent amount of money back into the economy, then I consider that to be net deflationary because it's just taking money out of circulation. It's definitely inflationary for that small basket of goods we're talking about.
Yeah.
But let's say they spend an equivalent amount of money or a multiple of that amount of money back into the economy, then that's inflationary. But it's there's multiple steps in the process as I see it.
Yeah.
And that would be the MMT view.
But I think it's about inflation is local and national at the same time. So I still can piss and moan about wine costing. And I'm going to.
You felt it.
Going to. So inflation is local. It's anecdotal. It's the individual touch points. So you can't forget that if you're going into a shop or whatever, if you're on Temu, although Temu probably has inflation, they're probably deflationary. But anyway, you're going to spend money on something and the price goes up, whatever it is, that's inflation.
That's right.
Of goods in the nation makes it on a national level inflation. So I'm still going to piss and moan about the
one. I accept that,
even
Michael.
Even if it's redistributed and the money's going back into something and it is going back into harm reduction because people do drink a lot and then they get in the streets and then they headbutt people, which is bad.
Sure, you could do worse than making grog more expensive, I guess. It's not the most egregious abuse of power. Okay, to you it is. I accept that.
If you made it cheaper, yeah, and you gave it to kids, and you gave them vapes, that would be really bad. You're probably right. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have time or the interest in touching on Musk and the Treasury?
Yeah, let's talk about it. This will be our closing discussion.
Sure. So, yeah, current affair. So, Musk wants to cut $2 trillion a year from Treasury payments. Doja. Yeah, it's so funny. Everyone's got a different pronunciation. I would say Doge. My dad would say Doggy.
Department of Government Efficiency.
Yes. Apparently, they have a website. So, I listened yesterday.
But that's government waste. That's government spending. Having a website, they're not preaching.
I think we, in terms of the scale of the situation, I think okay. We can forgive them the website. So, yesterday, perhaps the day before, Trump and Musk had a press conference. I listened to the first 15 minutes. It was hard to listen to.
He had his kid there for some reason. That was weird.
A bit of a prop, I guess.
Showing that he's not...
Just like a normal human being, you know. He's not a cyborg. Just a regular guy.
He's definitely part cyborg.
He's part something, but... taking over, yeah, influencing elections, buying elections, taking over the Treasury, pretty normal guy stuff to me, I reckon.
Yeah, America.
So he wants to cut $2 trillion from
from
federal spending. That's a big deal.
Which is deflationary.
Yes, which is interesting because, I mean, he operates a car company. He sells consumer goods. He sells cars. So it's interesting. It seems to be operating against his own self-interest there.
Yeah, it's a completely short-term strategy because, I mean, the whole thing about spending money, government spending money, is there's a thing called a multiplier. It was Keynes thing, and Edward Theodore, another amazing Australian treasurer, he had
a... Do you have one?
Oh, do I have a treasurer?
No, a money multiplier.
Do I have a money multiplier?
If you have one.
I don't, but I'm familiar with the concept.
Okay.
So
if it was a consumer good, I would purchase one.
Oh yeah, that'd be a great thing. So money going into pockets will go through other pockets. So I spend money, it goes throughout the economy and community. That's the money multiplier effect. So them spending that $2 trillion is going to create more than $2 trillion. But if they take that $2 trillion out of the economy, then people aren't going to the local hairdresser and getting a mullet. They're not going and, getting their teeth fixed. Well, if they do it in Turkey, then it's not going to help. But they're not sloshing money back around. So it's a very short-term strategy. They probably, they're not going to be buying Teslas because he's given over to the Germanic people recently.
Well, what's he doing? He's handing out vehicles. What's happening?
No. You know, that Germanic period in the 1993 to 1945...
Back to the future?
With the salute.
You mean 1933?
1933. What did I say?
1993,
oh,
I think.
Oh, man, no.
But, yeah, so, sorry, I'm with you. I missed the link there. So I know Musk is going full authoritarian Nazi salutes.
Yeah, that's what I was getting.
Speaking to the AfD in Germany, I know he's really committed to fascism or at the very least fascism light, or it might be the full strength fascism. We don't quite know yet.
We'll find out soon.
I'm worried.
We'll do that another
episode. Yeah.
From the steaming wreckage that is society.
Michael, did you have any final comments? I know I'm being greedy here trying to squeeze in one last thing, but tariffs. Do you have any thoughts on tariffs?
I've got thoughts on tariffs. There's a whole episode we need to do on tariffs. So tariffs can be a good thing, but again, it's social engineering. It's trying to force things to happen that you want to happen that might not be able to happen. So tariffs are a bit of an old retrograde thing. Some countries still use them to protect. So protectionism is a concept about protecting certain industries. So if there's an industry you specialize in, you have a competitive advantage in, then it's a government procedure or policy, rather, to protect that by putting up high tariff walls, by saying, okay, I'm going to make imports, I'm going to make you, if you want to buy a good from another country, I'm going to make that very expensive to you. So I'm going to encourage you to buy locally. And that's what a tariff is. So Germany, I'm pretty sure Germany still does this, and Japan still does this. Their own products they protect, so they want them consumed in the domestic economy. So they will say, if you're going to buy anything beyond a BMW or a Volkswagen or any other non-German car, it's going to cost 150% more than this car because I've put a tariff on that other product.
Yeah, so to be clear, the mechanism is the importer pays a duty to the government and the importer will pass on that cost to the consumer.
Yeah, and so, it can be a good thing because Australia used to make cars. Australia used to make Holdens. They weren't very good, but they were protected. And because they were protected, people would buy them. And because people buy them, we had a massive domestic manufacturing sector.
Yeah.
And countries should have massive domestic manufacturing sectors so they can make stuff. But they can also innovate and make new stuff. So as technology changes, they can be ready to make new stuff. In times of war, they can make munitions. So it's tanks and bombs and planes and drones. So it's incredibly important for someone to have a domestic manufacturing sector. When it doesn't make any sense is if the product you're making is so bad and people want access to different products. They can't go elsewhere. So tariffs are good if you're protecting an industry that's got a local manufacturing sector, then tariffs can be good.
Yeah, I think it's a trade-off between being independent as a country and having the best value and the best access to international goods.
Let me tell you when tariffs are bad. Tariffs are bad when they trigger a trade war. So in the World War II, when Japan was importing iron to make products, there were so many tariffs put in place and barriers that trade war was started and they said, we'll just go into war, that'll be good and then we'll reset everything. Trump sort of thing, he's doing his tariffs for a belligerent, you could always say warmongering reason. He's trying to start a trade war. He's said that himself before. And a trade war just means that you do way less trade. Everything costs way more money. We can't sell our red wine and lobsters to China, and people get annoyed. So you've got the people are the ones that suffer. One, everything costs more. Two, you can't export stuff that you used to. And three, if you follow the episode 1 and 2 of Star Wars, if you have a trade war, then it can lead to the rise of Anakin being Darth Vader. And then you can make out with Padme, which is quite weird.
Okay.
Because it was... Have you seen that episode 1 and 2 recently?
Nah, man.
Well, episode 1, he's like a child. He's like 6. And Padme's like 16. And then in episode 2, you presume they're the same age unless there's some weird breakdown in the space-time continuum. And then they make out.
So
he's probably like 20 and she's probably like 30. But at one point, she was like 16, he was like 6.
Yeah, I think provided they're doing it when they're 20 and 30, I think that's okay. Don't have an issue with that.
Yeah, but she was hanging out with him when he was 6 and she was 16.
Well, as long as they weren't doing any nonsense then, I think it's all above
board. I don't think they were. They didn't show it in the episode 1 anyway.
And I don't know the extent of their relationship.
But anyway, there was a trade war involved. And, of course, then the Death Star and all of that good stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, trade wars are bad. Tariffs protect industries. Good. Thumbs up. Tariffs that start trade wars, bad. Thumbs down.
Well, yeah, I don't think you can separate the two, Michael, because it's like protecting... Because any tariff that protects an industry, okay, so it's good for that industry, but there's still negative consequences as well.
I think there's a whole episode in this. I don't know this little snack,
All right. I'll finish my point and then we'll close it. We'll close it out. But I'm just saying the downside is the consumer doesn't have access to cheap goods anymore. So is it not everyone wins, right?
For which part?
So you're saying a tariff that protects an industry is good, but a tariff that incites a trade war is bad. I'm saying they can be one and the same. And in the scenario where you're protecting an industry, that's not 100% good for everyone because the consumer that was enjoying cheap Chinese goods and then you put a tariff on the goods.
Yeah, totally. So Protectionism is about jobs. Protectionism is about consumer choice.
And independence.
Want. Yeah. And it's protectionism is, and this is why, you know, back in the day before we argued about other stuff, we would argue about free trade and protectionism. And the free traders were like, well, let's sell goods to everywhere and let's have no tariffs. And that's where our FTAs, our modern FTAs exist. Or they would go, no, let's protect everything. Let's keep wages high and keep people buying goods, not because they're any good, because they don't have access to anything else. So you're hoodwinking the consumer by reducing all their choices. It's sort of like Soviet Russia. They don't have any, they've got one option for coffee, one option for biscuits. So that's it. Get used to one coffee and love it, you sucker.
Well said.
Thank you.
Michael, I think we can call it there.
Episode two, inflation. I think we covered it.
Yeah, I think some sense did commence in the end.
New name, by the way. Did you pick up on that? Let the sense commence. We weren't talking about skeptical bulls, but no one could spell it.
So. Look, I don't think we had many listeners for episode one, so we don't need to worry terribly about that. I apologize.
I reckon there's some repeat customers.
There will be. Michael, I was so enthusiastic about this episode that I got up very early this morning to try and study economics to be prepared for this. And I feel like I didn't quite get there and I'm not quite used to the early morning, but I hope it was worthwhile. I enjoyed this.
I think it was great. If you, next time you go and reach for a can of dog food and it's gone up, that was inflation. And now hopefully you understand a little bit more about what caused it. What are you going to do about it? Sorry, there's not much you're going to do about it. That's the cruel reality. We are economic units within a broader puppet show.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Over.